Well, welcome back to the study of Proverbs. I trust you have found these studies in this Old Testament wisdom book encouraging and enlightening and such that you are drawn to Jesus Christ and the Father. We now enter into chapter 30, and of course we're very near completing the book. In chapter 30, there are three chapters in Proverbs that present difficulty. Chapter 8, chapter 30, and chapter 31. And they present difficulty in different ways. Chapter 8 is really controversial in that, as you know, if you listen to the podcast for Chapter 8, there has been a tradition of recognizing the Savior Jesus Christ in chapter 8. And yet some some more recent Bible expositors have not liked that. They don't like that done. But it is possible, and it is a good thing. But that's a controversy of chapter 8. And then we get to chapter 30 as we are now, and this chapter has the difficulty of being very hard to understand. We would call that interpretive. It's highly interpretive. That is, it is able to be interpreted many ways, and that's a difficulty. And in fact, major major evangelical sources have actually written this chapter off and just said, you know, it's just too difficult to understand. It's crazy. It's weird. It makes no sense. So that's the second difficult chapter. And then the third is chapter 31, which has really been maligned and been dissed, you know, abused and disrespected. So, as we as we near the end of the book, we find that it ends with a bang. Proverbs ends with a bang. It has two of the three most difficult chapters at the end, and we are starting on one of them right now. to prepare you for that, I'll remind you that we did have a kind of a map. Excuse me. We did have kind of a map at the very beginning, at the outset of this study of Proverbs, and that map divided the whole book into three sections: the youth section, which was chapters 1 through 9; the general section, which was chapters 10 through 29; and now the guest section, which is chapters 30 and 31. And here's what those things mean. The youth section means Solomon is appealing to youth. And as you may recall, that youth is actually in progressively older age stages through those chapters. The general section is just Solomon's general comment. He has a lot of verses in that bulk of the book, 10 through 29, in which he just showers the reader with advice, with wisdom. So that's the general section. And then we're calling the guest section these last two chapters, which are not Solomon's. Chapter 30 is a guest speaker, and chapter 31 is another guest speaker. And that's where we are now. And let's go ahead and jump into chapter 30. As a key verse, I would like to look at the last two verses of the chapter. I would call that the key verse. In other words, the verse or passage that sets the tone for the chapter. So let's read that. Verse 32. If you've been foolish in exalting yourself, or if you have plotted evil, put your hand on your mouth, for the churning of milk produces butter, and pressing the nose brings forth blood, so the churning of anger produces strife. Now, not only is this a key passage and a representative passage for the chapter, it is also something else, even more significant, and we'll look at that in just a moment. So let's jump in. What we have is let's go ahead and read, and then we'll parse it. Chapter 30, verse 1. The words of Agur, the son of Jekah, the oracle. The man declares to Ithiel and Ural. Now let's stop right there. That's verse 1. Many different versions have basically two renderings of this one verse. Two very different renderings. And there's a reason, and it's a very simple reason. The reason is, in many versions of the Bible, King James, New American Standard, and others, it is just as I read. We have the man declares to Ithiel and Ukal, and those are names. So we have actually five names right there in the first verse. Agur, Jekah, Ithiel, no, four names, Ithiel and Ukal. And more recent renderings, you know, Bible study and investigation into this passage have actually rendered that differently. And that is, instead of the names being names, what the ESV and the NLT render these as is actually statements. And you can see how that could be. You know, the language is like that. Language has a lot of symbolism, and sometimes the symbolism is meant to stay a symbol, sometimes it's meant to be something else. And so the more modern rendering is different. And it is simply... Well, let me read it to you. Agur is saying in verse 1, instead of naming names the way we have here, the more modern translations have this, I am weary, I am worn out. That's simple. I am weary, I am worn out. The Septuagint, which you may recall, is... the Old Testament translated to Greek for the use by Jews who had more or less lost much of their culture before, coming back together in just before the advent of Christ. And this was a Greek translation of the Old Testament. And in the Septuagint, we find it in even different rendering, and that is Agur is saying, I'm going to say this much, and then I'll stop. So you can see what's happening here. Agur is speaking of himself, and he'll speak of himself for 10 verses. Now let's back up a moment. Who is Agur? We don't know. Some people suppose that he may be Solomon, going by another name, a pseudonym, if you like. That's not entirely impossible, because even the next chapter has Solomon being identified by a pseudonym, Lemuel. So that's not unusual, but I don't know if there's a whole lot of Bible teachers who ascribe to that interpretation. So I think for the most part, we would have to say that this person, Agur, is just someone we don't know. We don't know who he is. There's no reference to him anywhere else but here. I'm going to take the position that he, you know, when in chapter 25, excuse me, in chapter 25, you know that there's a break in the book, and it says there that Hezekiah, who was more than 200 years after Solomon, added to the book of Proverbs more of Solomon's writings that had not been collected yet. And, you know, we're told that Solomon wrote some 3,000 Proverbs. We're told that in 1 Kings. So, yeah, there were a lot of things he wrote, a lot of things he said. So Hezekiah and his men added to the book from 25 onward. So what I'm saying is there was some, you know, there was some administration of this book, some assembling of this book over the years. And I feel, I have no proof of this, but I feel that Agur was probably a transcriptionist, you know, a transcriber, or maybe just a an observer of the process of putting the book together. Or maybe he was just another person who was considered wise, who was invited to add, or let's say Hezekiah's men decided to add his writings. Now, I prefer to think that he was a contemporary, or close to a contemporary of Solomon's, and that he is actually commenting on the book. That actually fits the best interpretation, I believe. So let's go on. Verse 2, surely I am more stupid than any man, and I do not have the understanding of a man. Wow. So verse 1, he says, I'm weary, I'm worn out. And verse 2, he says, I'm stupid. In NLT, the New Living Translation, has it as, I am too stupid to be human. Let's stop a moment. Do people really call themselves stupid? Not very often. Not very often. I think this is a bit of, you know, poetic hyperbole. And what he's really saying is, he's already said, I am weary, I'm worn out. And now he's saying, I am no sage. I am nobody special, he's saying. I'm weary, I'm worn out. We could just shorten that to wow. Verse 1 is just wow, okay? Assuming he's read the first 29 chapters and he's commenting on those, he says, wow. And then verse 2, I am nobody special. Now, there is precedence for that kind of perspective throughout Scripture. And there's you can find one in Amos. The book of Amos, the tiny little book of Amos, where Amos says, "Hey, I'm just a fig grower, and I'm nobody special. I'm nobody." So that does have some validity that we would say that Agur is presenting himself as that. So here we have Agur for the first 10 verses describing himself. So let's continue. Verse 3. Neither have I learned wisdom, nor do I have the knowledge of the Holy One. Now, don't overthink this. All he's saying is, he said, I am weary and worn out, I am nobody special, and I am not a wise man. I am not a learned person. I am unlearned, I am uneducated, I'm not a priest, I'm not a, you know, a big shot. So let's continue, verse 4. Who has ascended into heaven and descended? Who has gathered the wind in his fists? Who has wrapped the waters in his garment? Who has established all the ends of the earth? Sounds a lot like Psalms here. What is his name or his son's name? Surely you know. What is he saying there? Well, verse 4 is a long verse, but what is he saying? Well, I think he's saying three things. First of all, he says, he says, well, four things. He's saying four things. First of all, he says, who is like God in wisdom? He says, you know, I've read this book of Proverbs by Solomon, and there's so much wisdom in it, and it really all comes from God, and who can compete with him? Who is like God? And then he says, do you know him by his character? That's what he means when he says, what is his name? Do you know him? Because name in ancient times, when someone said, you know, the name of, and often we have in the Bible the name of God as a statement. In ancient times, that was referring to character, how you knew a person to be, what kind of person they were. So Agur says, do you know him by his character? And then when he says, what is his name? Of course, we just saw, but what is his son's name? He's saying, do you even have more intimate association with him? Do you really know him? Do you know him well? And then when he says, surely you know, and in the NAS, there's an exclamation point, surely you know, and the NLT has, tell me if you know, you know? What's he saying? I think he's being sarcastic. He's saying, you know, maybe you're as smart as God. Maybe you're as wise as God, he's saying. Or you could say it this way. No one on earth is as wise. So you see what he's doing? He's presenting himself as someone who just wants to say something. And then what he says is how great God is. And he's kind of bursting out in praise because he's read the wonderful things Solomon has written. All right, now let's look at verse 5. Every word of God is tested. He is a shield of those who take refuge in him. Do not add to his words, lest he reprove you, and you be proved a liar. What's he saying? Well, he's saying every word of God is perfect. Don't toy with it. Don't mess with it. Okay, that's pretty obvious. But how would we render this in the context of what he's already said, what he has said before? Well, that would be, he's saying, this stuff is above me and everyone else. So he introduces himself. He says, man, this is neat stuff. Isn't God neat? By the way, are you this smart? Do you even know God? Do you know him really well? No one is this wise. And then he says, and this stuff is just heavy duty. It's way beyond all of us. Do you see that? Now, verse 7. Two things I have asked of thee. Do not refuse me before I die. Keep deception and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is my portion. Lest I be full and deny thee and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be in want and steal and profane the name of my God. What's he saying there, 7 through 9? All he's saying is what he's already said. He says, fellas, I'm not trying to be somebody I'm not. I'm not saying that I'm like Solomon. I'm not saying that, you know, these are the same things I would have said if I had the chance. He's not saying that. He says, this is above me and everybody else, verses 5 and 6, and I'm not trying to be somebody I'm not, verses 7 through 9. That's all he's saying. He's saying, it's not me. It's God. It's not me. And then verse 10. Verse 10 seems to stand alone, doesn't seem to, you know, have any context, but let's read it. Do not slander a slave to his master, lest he curse you and you be found guilty. What is he saying? Does this connect to the previous verses? I think it does. I think all he's saying is, don't criticize me. I'm just a servant. So let's recap. He says, wow, this is neat stuff. You know, and by the way, I'm going to say some things, but, you know, I'm not anybody special. Don't think I'm, you know, I have any great, you know, credentials. I'm uneducated, but who is like God? Man, the wisdom of God. And do you know him? Are you even associated with him? Do you even know him well? And then he says, no one on earth. You might think you're wise, but no one on earth is as wise as God. And what God has said through Solomon Agur says, is above me and above everybody else. And then he says, and I'm not trying to you know, skank anyone. I'm not trying to, you know, pull a prank here. I am just like you. This stuff is beyond me too. And then he says, don't criticize me. He's anticipating what he's going to say next. He says, don't criticize me. I'm just a servant. So for these first 10 verses, what we have is an introduction. We have an introduction to the chapter 30, in which Agur, this guest speaker, if you will, is identifying himself, is saying some things about himself, and guess what? After verse 10, he won't say another word about himself. He's done. He will then embark on a kind of a sermon. And we can look at it a couple different ways, and I think they're both correct. It is a sermon. It actually has 24 points. A 24-point sermon. We'll get to that in a minute. But the other thing about it I want to mention is that it seems to be a commentary or kind of a summary, kind of an executive summary of the first 29 chapters of the book. It really does. He'll bring up many of the things almost in the same order that Solomon has done, but only in a very concise, you know, half a chapter. And so, instead of 29 chapters. And so that's kind of the way to look at it. It's Agur's sermon through the rest of chapter 30 is kind of commentary or emphasis or highlighting what Solomon has said before, right? Now, we could call this Agur's 24, as I mentioned, because what Agur does is he takes, this is poetry, this is Hebrew poetry, and what he's doing is grouping what he wants to say into four items. And he does this six times. He gives six vignettes. And in each vignette, he has four pieces. So six times four, 24. And what's interesting about it is, as you look at the four lines or four items in each chunk, in each paragraph, six paragraphs, what happens is at the end of each one of them, he's trying to say something about man. So even though, let's take an example. Let's go over to verse 15. The leech has two daughters, give, give. Now that's his opening. Now he says, here are three things that will not be satisfied, even four that will not say enough. And he'll keep saying that. Look at verse 18. Three things which are too wonderful for me, four which I do not understand. Verse 21, under three things the earth quakes, and under four it cannot build, cannot bear up. Do you see? So he's grouping everything into fours. And what he does is he uses the first three of each set of four to describe the fourth. Let's look at that over in verse 16. Begins at 15. There are three things that will not be satisfied, four which will not say enough. Sheol and the barren womb, that's one. Earth that is never satisfied with water, that's two. And fire that never says enough. All right. Now, you know from previous recordings that Sheol is not what many people believe. It's not the Old Testament version of hell. In fact, Old Testament saints didn't have much of a concept of hell. I think it was pretty rare. I think there were some people that understood it, but not many. What Sheol is, and it's pretty well agreed among scholars, that the Jews had really only a concept of darkness, death, you know, pit, the pit, you know, just, and some versions actually translate Sheol as the grave, and that's fairly accurate. So what it represents then is death. Sheol represents death. That's it. Not eternity, not, you know, any of those things. And that's a whole other discussion for another time. But back to verse 16. Sheol and the barren womb, earth that is never satisfied with water, and fire, excuse me, that never says enough. So we sang death, drought, and fire. Now, today we don't see those as the worst things that ever happened. We add earthquakes and, we add all kinds of things, pestilence and plagues and, But he's saying, here's some bad stuff. Death, drought, and fire. And those are three. And then look at the fourth. The eye that mocks a father and scorns a mother, the ravens of the valley will pluck it out, and the young eagles will eat it. So two things stand out here. Number one is he used the first three things to describe or to give background for the fourth. And he does that all the way through. So he sets us up with the three items, and then the fourth is his actual topic. The fourth is his actual subject that he's trying to get to, that he's trying to say something about. And let's look at this fourth. It's an insolent son, isn't it? It's an insolent son, or it could be a daughter. The eye that mocks a father and scorns a mother, the ravens of the valley will pluck it out, and the young eagles will eat it. Now that's hyperbole. Because if you believed that this was literal, you'd have to be looking all around for insolent children who had their eyes plucked out. I mean, that's not what's going on here. This is hyperbole, and it has some real significance. He's saying that if you as a child talk back to and despise, by the way, the word Hebrew there is despise, scorns a mother in verse 17. The Hebrew there is despise, hate. If you hate your parents, if you talk back to your parents, he's saying, you can expect to not have a great life. This will not go well for you. And you know what? That's actually in Ephesians. If you look in the New Testament book of Ephesians, Paul reiterates it. He doesn't mention the eagles plucking the eyes out, but he does say that it may go well with you. And of course, he's quoting one of the Ten Commandments. Now, this is interesting, but there's another level of this, of understanding this, and that is, to the Jews, when Agur describes a person whose eyes are being plucked out, presumably they're dead. And to the Jews, this would be a very ignoble, a very sad and desperate and unfortunate way to die, because it would be disrespecting the body at death. That was an important thing. So what Agur is saying is, he's saying, I'm gonna repeat some of the things Solomon said, he says, but I'm gonna say them in a different way, and just to make sure you didn't miss them, just to make sure, I'm gonna give you a summary, I'm gonna give you the highlights. And he says how bad it is to be a child that is in competition with his parents. How bad it is. Do you see? Do you see what he's done? So let's back up. And we actually didn't start at where he starts. So let's start at verse 11. But you're prepared now to see that he's going to have four things in almost every one of these paragraphs. He's going to have four things. And the four things, with maybe one exception, the four things are going to be subjects that are really just transitions into the last one, which is really what he wants to say, what he really wants to talk about. Okay, let's start in verse 11. There's a kind of man who curses his father and does not bless his mother. There is a kind who is pure in his own eyes, yet is washed from his filthiness. Not washed from his filthiness. There is a kind, oh, how lofty are his eyes, and his eyelids are raised in arrogance. There is a kind of man whose teeth are like sores, and his jaw teeth like knives, to devour the afflicted from the earth, and the needy from among men. Now, Agur has really commented on three or four things that Solomon talked about. Look how he starts out. Curses his father and does not bless his mother. Well, that's the raising of children, which is how Solomon started the book. Then he goes into pure in his own eyes, yet not washed from his filthiness. Well, that's arrogance and self-wisdom, which, again, Solomon spent a lot of time talking about. And then you have, in verse 14, whose teeth are like swords and his jaw teeth like knives to devour the... Well, like knives. That's speech. And Solomon had a lot to say about speech that hurts. It can heal or it can harm. And then the last thing in verse 14, to devour the afflicted from the earth and the needy from among men. Those are also things that Solomon spent a lot of time on, and that is how some people prey on other people, especially people in power, especially people in authority, who prey on and take advantage of people who are needy and lowly. Do you see that? Agur is restating what Solomon has said. So there's the four things there, and then we just saw the one 15 through 17, the death and the drought and the fire. Now let's look at 18, verse 18. There are three things which are too wonderful for me, four which I do not understand. Now let's back up. The word wonderful isn't quite the way we think of the word wonderful. Here. It is different. The word actually it means unpredictable, unaccountable, uncomprehendable. You know, mysteries, let's say. Mysteries. In the NLT, it says, they amaze me. Okay? So let's get started. There are three things which are too wonderful for me, four which I do not understand. The way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship in the middle of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. Now, the word maid there is, we would translate that virgin. And if you've read very much of the Bible or had any teachings from the Bible, you know that the word virgin, you know, it connotates something sexual to our age, our culture. But back then, the word virgin really meant, more than anything, and it could be a man or a woman, by the way, meant someone who was so young they were still under the protection of their parents. In fact, the root word is to protect, to shield, to close in. So this is just a very young person. And since it's called a maid, and since it's rendered maid here, then that means a very young girl. Probably just on the verge of being marriageable age. Or just having reached marriageable age. This is an intriguing thing. And look how he does this. Eagle, serpent, ship. All right, eagle, serpent, ship. Those are non-human things, obviously. And then he ends with a human. You see? And he does this through most of his sermon. He sets us up with parallels, with descriptors, and then he, boom, lands the real thing he wants to say at the end. So the real thing he wants to say is something about the man and the woman, the man and the maid. To understand what it is he's saying, let's decide what is the subject here. Is the subject the ship and the eagle and the serpent, the snake? No, those are the secondary subjects. The primary subject is the way. The way. And the way there is kind of interesting. It means path or conduct or dance. And in fact, the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, makes it track, which is very evocative. It's a very evocative rendering. So Agur is saying, I want to focus on the track of a man and a young lady. The track. What happens between them? You could call this young romance, young love. Now, why does he say track of an eagle? Well, think about it. If you look in the sky and you see an eagle, what do you think? Freedom, beauty, completeness, appropriateness, just an overall really organic thing, huh? Very beautiful, delightful, organic thing, right? Well, ship in the sea, snake on a rock. Agar is saying, I think he's saying, these are things that have some beauty and some mystery, and God has made them in such a way that they're not really approachable. We don't really understand them. We can't really parse them. We can't really dissect them and you know, make them make sense. And he says, this is actually the way it is with young love. Yeah, that's what he's saying. Now, what's the point of that? Well, I think, again, he's just picking up, you know, he's just piggybacking, if you like, on some of the things Solomon has said. And one of the things Solomon has said is how great marriage is, how wonderful it is. And in one of the chapters, I forget which one right now, but in one of them he talks about making sure you cultivate, I could flip to it, but make sure you cultivate in your marriage your physical relation, your intimacy, and develop it and turn it into a hedge against temptation, you know, with other people, to have the same relationship as other people, because you're not supposed to, and so forth. He seems to be celebrating that dynamic, that chemistry, that and the way he says it, you know, the track, you know, when you watch an eagle and you see it fly, I mean, what if you come around the next day and you see another one? Is it going to look exactly the same as the first one? No, it's different. It's very artful, isn't it? It's very holistic. It's very organic. And the same with a ship, and the same with a snake. So what's he saying? He's saying we can't really, you know, we can't really predict, we can't really explain, you know, in harsh scientific terms, what happens between a man and a young lady. Now, verse 20 is very controversial. First of all, when we read verse 20, if we were to include that in Agur's little vignette here, you know, 18 through, you know, 18 and 19, if we were to include verse 20, it wouldn't be 4, it'd be 5. So there's one reason I don't think it really is part of what he's saying. I don't think it's really part of it. Another thing is, some translation actually recognize that. Some translations actually cut 20 and move it down into its own paragraph, separating it from 18 and 19. And I think that's appropriate. I think that's valid. What I'm saying is, let's go ahead and read 20. What I'm saying is, I don't really know what 20 is doing there, but I have some ideas. Let's read verse 20. This is the way of an adulterous woman. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, I have done no wrong. Now, many commentators, in fact, some very famous and well-known Bible teachers have said, well, then what Agur is talking about in 18 and 19, and what he, you know, obviously gets to at verse 19 when he says his real point, he must be talking about fornication. He must be, in other words, he must be talking about something bad. He must be being very negative. But I don't think so. I don't think so. Because how could an eagle in the sky and a ship on the sea and a snake on a rock, how can those things be construed as typifying, you know, evil, typifying, you know, something bad? I don't think so. But what I think happened is when he got to verse 19 and he describes the inexplicable relationship of a man and a young woman, I think in verse 20 he says, you know, I've said how wonderful it is, how unpredictable it is. It can go, you know, different ways. And he says in verse 20, and here's one of the ways it could go. He just adds it on. He just tacks it on in the end there and saying, and this is how that could go. So 19 and 20 should be considered kind of together. And it keeps it as a four, do you see? Four items. Now, that's my interpretation. I don't know, you know, how many people would go along with that. In fact, I looked up different renderings of this, and I found about four different interpretations. So I don't know, but this is mine, and I like it. But notice something here. In verse 19, inside of this concept of what the wonder of young love, inside of that is the presumption that the man is the initiator and the woman is the receiver, and by definition that makes her vulnerable. She can be taken advantage of by the man. Verse 19 isn't saying that she is. It's saying that there is that vulnerability. The woman is vulnerable. But look what happens in verse 20. The man becomes vulnerable. The man is taken advantage of, potentially. There's no taking advantage of in verse 19, don't get me wrong. But there's potential for it. And in verse 20, we have that flipped on its head. We have the man being vulnerable and the woman being the pursuer. Isn't that interesting? Anyway, so that's one of the more controversial sections of this chapter. Now verse 21. Under three things the earth quakes, and under four it cannot hold up. It cannot bear up. Wow. The language there is kind of interesting. This whole thing about quaking. A lot of different versions have tremble there. And in fact, even the Septuagint has tremble. The ESV, the Septuagint, the NLT, and the Living Bible all have trembles. The earth trembles. It quakes. It cannot withstand. Agur is saying. This is hyperbole, obviously. But it cannot withstand what he's going to talk about. The King James has disquieted. The New King James has perturbed. The earth. This is hyperbole, all right? He's saying there's trouble coming. This, what I'm going to describe to you is trouble, so watch out. That's what he's saying, okay? Under three things, verse 21, the earth quakes. Under four, it cannot bear up. Under a slave when he becomes king. And a fool when he is satisfied with food. Under an unloved woman when she gets a husband. And a maidservant when she supplants her mistress. What is he saying? Well, it's hard to tell. It's interesting that these are all people. There's no animals or other objects being used as substitutes. But he is saying some interesting things. Verse 22, a servant who suddenly becomes a leader. What do you think? What do you think? We have an example of that, actually. Who was it? Who was it? Was it Ishbosheth? I think it was Ishbosheth. It might have been somebody else. In the days of the kings, there was someone who became a leader after being a nobody. Actually, I can think of another one as well. There was another one. Anyway, so what do you think happens when a servant becomes a leader? What do you think what happens when someone changes from one state to a much, much higher state? What do you think is likely to happen? They're not going to be up to the challenge in most cases. In most cases. That's all he's saying. They're not going to be up to the challenge. He is just commenting or adding to what Solomon has said already in the first 29 chapters. The second one, a fool who is satiated. Well, here's the deal. When he is satisfied, when he gets something he wants and is really, really complete, really acquired it, and in his content that he has acquired it, is he going to be any less a fool? No. In fact, he may be more. Yeah, that's the wisdom of Solomon. How about the unloved woman? The Septuagint has a really insightful rendering here. The Septuagint has this as a hateful woman. That is someone who has had relationships in the past and just they've all failed. She's been hard to deal with. She's been hard to live with. She's been hard to get along with. That's the point. Who then marries an unsuspecting man. You get it? What pathos. What incredible picture of this woman who's presumably quite a shrew, quite a difficult one to be with, who finally traps a man, and boy is he in trouble. Boy is he in trouble. She's going to bring a lot of baggage to that marriage, and he is in lots of trouble. You know, Solomon has said quite a bit about this. There are several verses in the first 29 chapters where Solomon warns the man to not marry too hastily. Try to not get yourself locked up with a woman you can't get along with. And then the last one, a servant who usurps her mistress. That also we can find elsewhere in Scripture. Sarah and her maid, go way back to Leah and her maid, who had children. I think Sarah had a situation also, though. But Leah and her maid, who had Leah couldn't have as many children as she wanted, and so the maid, you know, was given the opportunity to have children, and then she turned on her, and of course, you know, that sort of thing. Ill feeling, right? Ill feeling, certainly. Interesting things. I'm not sure how useful they are to our faith in the Lord, but they do show Agur commenting on, expanding on, and adding to what Solomon has said already. All right, verse 24. Four things are small on the earth, and this is probably the most powerful paragraph in this chapter. Four things are small on the earth, but they are exceedingly wise. The actual Hebrew there is wiser than the wise. So Agur is saying there are four things, and he's going to have animals here, and he's going to say that out of proportion to what you would think of them, out of proportion to how you would respect them, out of proportion to how you would normally think they would get along in life, instead they're very successful. They're extremely successful animals despite their shortcomings, despite their natural weaknesses. So let's see how he works it. 25. The ants are not a strong folk, but they prepare their food in the summer. The badgers are not mighty folk. That's a kind of a... The actual word there is rabbits, wild rabbits. The badgers are not mighty folk, yet they make their houses in the rocks. The locusts have no king, yet all of them go out in ranks. The lizard you may grasp with the hands, yet it is in kings' palaces. Now, this is a very impactful paragraph because this is one that really has the most to teach us. It really has the most that we can apply to our lives today. What he's saying is there are four animals, Agur says, that you would do well to emulate. They have characteristics, or he's anthropomorphizing them, okay? Obviously, there's some real stretching of the analogy here. But he's anthropomorphizing. He's saying, ants, even as tiny as they are, and so vulnerable, and so insignificant, and yet, they do great things in their economy. They build bridges. Have you ever seen ants surround an insect, like a dragonfly or a bee or something, or a dead one, and move it? Have you ever seen that? It's remarkable. It really is. He says, the ants are not a strong folk, yet they prepare their food in the summer. What's the picture there? What is the attribute that he says a human being should have? Again, it's anthropomorphizing, because ants don't have industrialness. They don't have industry. I mean, not really. unless you say the Lord gave them this instinct, and you could say that God gave them the instinct. Okay, that's accurate. But what is Agur saying? He's saying the same thing that Solomon said. Do you remember what Solomon said? He said, "Go to the ant, O sluggard, and observe her ways." You remember reading that? That's in Proverbs. Agur's just saying the same thing. He's saying, you know, Solomon said, "Go to the ant," but what he means is, check out how industrious they are. The attribute, the characteristic that you would do well to emulate, again, you have to anthropomorphize to do it, but to emulate is their industry, how hard they work. Yeah, yeah. This is really instructive. Let's look at the next one. The badgers, or wild rabbits, or horaxes, some versions have, are not a mighty folk. In fact, the Hebrew says they're feeble. They're feeble. They're timid. What do you call a man who doesn't act very manly? What do you call him? Call him a rabbit. Yeah. Yeah. He's talking about timidity here. Again, I'm anthropomorphizing now, but this is all poetry. He says, these animals that represent timidity in, today and presumably back then, he says, yet they make their houses in the rocks. Well, what attribute is that? Well, we would say humility. They recognize their weakness, and yet they do something about it. They do something about their shortcoming that makes them have some power, makes them have defensibleness. They can defend themselves. Isn't that interesting? They overcome their vulnerability by the choice of their home. Yeah, yeah. Okay, that's an attribute that we could take on, humility. 27, the locusts have no king, yet all of them go out in ranks. Well, that's interesting. He's saying the locusts don't have a sergeant or a colonel or something to guide them, and yet they act as if they do. They don't march, of course. They fly, but I guess the word would be swarm. But how do they do it? They swarm in bunches, you know. I mean, no blue angels, no acrobatic, you know, jet pilots, you know, team of jets had a more beautiful and more remarkable display of unity and of cohesiveness than a swarm of locusts. He's saying that's an interesting thing. Agur has observed this, and he's saying, yet all of them go out in ranks. So what attribute is that? What characteristic can a human derive from that? And you know what Agur is saying? He's saying that God made these things for us to observe. He made them for us to observe. So what's he saying? What attribute is it? They swarm, and this swarming compensates for the lack of leadership. And what is that compensation? It's cooperation. It's community. It's community. The locusts know, somehow, as do a lot of other animals, birds, for example, how to do things or be together as a whole, as a team, as a solid unit. That's community. So we have industry, exemplified by ants. We have humility, exemplified by rabbits. We have community, exemplified by the locusts. Now, verse 28. The lizard you may grasp with the hands, yet it is in kings' palaces. This apparently is not the best rendering. Some other versions have that just as the lizard has hands, and if you ever looked at a lizard, they do look like hands. They look like human hands. The lizard has hands, and so he would be thought to be very, able and skilled in, surviving. And yet, despite his hands, the human hand can grab him very easily and overcome him. That's kind of the picture there. But let's read it. The lizard you may grasp with the hands, yet is in king's palaces. So what's going on here? What's going on here? This is an interesting thing. And I don't really know exactly how to put this together. Because we would expect this last one to be talking about a human being. And it's not. It's a lizard. But notice something. Notice something. The ant. Notice how the ants are spoken of as plural. Notice how the badgers or rabbits are spoken of as plural. Notice how the locusts are spoken of as plural. And then you get to the lizard. That's singular. That is interesting. Maybe it's just a technique so that the word hand makes sense, because you couldn't take a hand and grab many of them, you know, at one time. So maybe that's just a technique or a vehicle for bringing in the hand. I don't know. But I have a feeling that this is really a metaphor for a human being, for a man. I don't know. It's just my idea. But there is something else going on here. He says, the lizard is vulnerable because it's easy to catch him, and he, you know, doesn't have many defenses, right? He's pretty vulnerable. But how does he overcome that vulnerability? Well, we're given a clue when it says he's found in king's houses. He doesn't say any house. He says king's houses. Interesting, isn't it? In other words, the lizard succeeds. The idea of the king gives you success. You know, that's he's in a place where he wouldn't expect to be. You could even say he's exalted, if you like. So what is that? What characteristic is that? It's perseverance. It's perseverance. And you could add enterprise to that. Perseverance and enterprise. So the lizard, Agur says, seems a pretty insignificant animal, easy to get him, easy to catch him. He's really not very much of a defender of himself, pretty vulnerable, and yet he succeeds in living in the house with the king. He's able to do very well for himself. Yeah, that's pretty interesting. Pretty interesting. So characteristics, industry, humility, community, and perseverance. Very interesting lessons that Agur's given us in this paragraph. All right, verse 29. There are three things which are stately on their march, even four which are stately when they walk. The lion, which is mighty among beasts and does not retreat before any. The strutting cock, the male goat also, and now look, he goes from animals to a person again. A king when his army is with him. So what is this? These are pictures. Agur's been looking at lions, and he's been looking at the rooster, and he's been looking at the billy goat, and he says, you know, these animals, they portray a certain attitude of imperiousness, you know. Of kind of arrogant, you know, that sort of thing. If you look up imperiousness, it means bold, proud, and expecting submission, expecting people to obey them, which would be true of the king, who's been victorious, right? He's after, especially in the ancient times, but even somewhat today. You have this leader or this king who's just won a battle. He's had a military victory. And what does he do when he comes back into his homeland? There's pomp and ceremony, right? He struts, he parades, he, you know, looks all victorious, that sort of thing. And what is Agur saying? He's just observing. There's really not much of a lesson in this paragraph. He's just observing. He says, you know, not only, the previous paragraph, he said, here are some qualities of animals that we can emulate and learn from. And now he's talking about some qualities in animals that they're otherwise. They're not ones to copy. They're not ones to emulate. You know, the strutting, you know, and the pride and the arrogance. And he says they're not, you know, these are also qualities. Isn't that interesting? So then we have the end of the chapter. Verse 32, have you been foolish in exalting yourself? Huh. Isn't that interesting? He just talked about exalting yourself. Or if you've plotted evil, put your hand on your mouth, for the churning of milk produces butter, and pressing the nose brings forth blood, so the churning of anger produces strife. Well, let's go back to the Septuagint for a good reflection on this. And that is, the Septuagint actually says, where it says the last line there, churning of anger produces strife, the Septuagint reads, if you crank up your words, you will produce strife. Isn't that interesting? He begins with, if you're exalting yourself, and then he gives, you know, analogies of, you know, making butter, you know, making yourself bleed, and then anger. And he says, this is the human condition. This is how he started his chapter. Do you remember in verse 11? This is how he started it. In verse 11, he says how proud we are and how prone to saying things with our words that cause problems. And look what he says here. If you crank up the word machine, if you give vent to your pride, especially, or your anger, or any of those emotions, and if you let them out in words, you are asking for trouble. You're producing strife. You're producing trouble. And that's how he ends the chapter. So he hits a lot of the high points. He doesn't obviously cover everything that Solomon has said. He'd have to have another 29 chapters. But he is saying, he is reflecting on the things that impressed him, the things that stuck out for him, or, you know, summarizing on some of the more important points, or hitting the highlights, however you want to describe it. And look what he starts and ends with. The condition of fallen man, which is what the book of Proverbs is about. You know, there's almost no law in the book of Proverbs. When Proverbs asks us to be different than we are, which is mostly what it's doing, it doesn't use the law to do that. It doesn't bring the law to bear on our behavior. Instead, it appeals to the heart. You'll recall that 227 times the book of Proverbs refers to your heart, more than any other book in the Bible. And what Agur's doing here is saying, you've read this book of Proverbs, you've seen your personal diary opened and exposed. This is what you look like. Yeah. In a sense, we could call the whole book evangelical. In a sense. It's hard to really get the gospel from it, except in maybe chapter 8. But as a whole, the book isn't really that evangelical. But in a sense, it is. In the sense that before you can understand the good news and appreciate the good news, that's what gospel means, the good news, you have to know the bad news. And the bad news is what we are. What we are like. Yeah. That's why it says, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. That's how Paul does it in Romans chapter 3. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Which is a funny wording. It just means that God set a standard and we missed. God said, this is the way I want you to behave, and we didn't. That's all it means. That's part of the gospel. It's the important part of the gospel. We have to know that first. We have to know that we are sinners in need of a Savior. And that is at least the implied message of Proverbs, the implied message. Well, I hope you've benefited from this chapter. We have one more to go. And as I said, it may be one of the most difficult chapters in the book of Proverbs, in some sense. And that difficulty really comes from us assuming certain things about the chapter that aren't so, that I believe aren't so. And so we'll look at this chapter in a, I don't want to say a new way, but in a way that I think it was meant to be looked at. And we, and by and large, we haven't been seeing it. So stay tuned for that. And as always, believe God.